right, so this is,
again, in keeping with thy kingdom come and the law of the tithe, this is specifically the law of the tithe, and this is part two. But before I get into part two, I'd like to review just a little bit, just briefly. And before I even do that, I'd like to read our, what I said was going to be kind of our theme verse again, Proverbs chapter 3, or verses 9 and 10 says, honor Yahweh from your wealth and from the first of all your produce. And then the promise, so your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. So that's the result of our giving to Yahweh. In fact, the result of our honoring Him from the first fruits of our produce. I'd like to read a little more. This is in Tithing and Dominion by Powell and Rush Dooney, and I read some of this, the same pages last time, but I did not read all this. I want to read some of the same things and a little bit more. So this is Tithing and Dominion. And it says, any discussion of taxation, and by the way, I'll interject here. Remember, we said that the tithe is truly a kingdom tax. The tithe is kingdom tax. Tithe, tribute, tax. Any discussion of taxation must involve the discussion of sovereignty because they are indivisible. Also, I'll interject here. I read a little bit out of this book, The World Under God's Law, last time, and remember he said when the question of authority is raised, all other questions fade to the background because authority is what everything else rides on. Everything revolves around that. And back again from Tithing and Dominion. The power to tax, the power to tax is the claim of ownership and control over man and his possessions. And this claim of ownership is the claim of sovereignty. Just kind of let that sink in. The power to tax is the claim of ownership and the control over man and his possessions. And this claim of ownership is the claim of sovereignty. This can be understood by examining the state's claim to the power to tax. Every tax by the state on both man and his property is, in essence, the claim of sovereignty. It is the claim by the state that it has ownership of and control over man and his possessions. If a man refuses to pay the tax required by the state can deny that individual the use of his property and, at times, his life and liberty. For instance, if you don't pay a tax they demand and they throw you in jail, they're taking from you your life and liberty and claiming ownership of you. They're saying, we own you and we're going to throw you in here and lock you up for a while till you learn to be a good little boy or girl. So thus denying him his life and liberty. The use of a man's life, liberty, and property are contingent upon him paying his taxes. The fact that the state claims the right to deny man his life, liberty, and property if he refuses to pay his taxes is simply the claim by the state that it is the ultimate owner of man and his material goods. Taxation is the means by which the state claims prior ownership and control over all that a man has. This can be seen by the fact that taxes are to be paid prior to the use of a man's property, and in the case of a head or poll tax, prior to the use of his life and liberty. Taxation is always a claim of ownership. Every tax levied is a claim that the property that has been taxed is owned by the state. And I'll depart from the book here for a moment again. Is that true, that the tax levied by the state on property is the claim that the state owns the property? Absolutely. And if you don't pay your property tax, what do? They throw you off of there and put somebody on the property that'll pay the tax. So do they claim ownership? Absolutely. And when we get there, which I've got a list of scriptures we're going to go through about ownership, Yahweh owns the property, and he hasn't given the authority to anybody else to claim ownership and tax it. He said that the land won't be taxed. So that's getting ahead of myself. So, let's see, I lost my place now. It does not matter what form the property takes. If, for example, a man refuses to pay his property tax on his home, then the state can deny him the use of his home. It can confiscate it and sell it to others who are willing to pay the taxes that the state demands for the use of this house. If a man refuses to pay the tax that the state has levied against his income, then his income and or other property can be confiscated to satisfy the state's claims of prior ownership of his income. By the way, your income, what you produce with your life, is your life. There, you have nothing else. You have nothing but your allotted time on this earth. That's all you have. You and I don't own anything, really. But when it talks in the last book of the Bible about how she's stolen in the souls of men, how do they steal our souls? They steal our lives from us by taking our time and what we've produced with our time, and by taking our property. So that's what he's bringing up here. But I want you to catch the use of his word confiscate. In Yahweh's law, who has the power to confiscate? Who has authority to confiscate? Only Yahweh. Only Yahweh. Any tax, people complain about some taxes, but listen, if it's a tax that doesn't have confiscatory powers, it's, you know, you, a lot of times you have some say about those taxes. For instance, a sales tax. You go out here and buy a brand new, say, a $40,000 truck, you're going to pay some sales taxes. Well, you can, to a degree, you can have something to say about how much taxes you pay. You go buy a $4,000 truck. You know? You pay a lot less taxes that way. That's my method, yeah. So, and if you don't want to pay that tax, you don't go buy a new truck. And nobody comes to confiscate anything from you. And I'm not saying the sales tax is fair or equitable or just, or that they're making good use of that sales tax money either. I'm not saying that. But I'm just giving an example. But any tax that has with it confiscatory powers is brutal and ruthless and totally against the law. Again, I'm back to the book now. Again, if a man refuses to pay the tax that the state levies on his automobile, then he is denied the use of it. And if he should use it, he can be subject to severe fines by the state for doing so. In extreme cases, the state, and of course, I think what he's mentioning here, the tax that you're paying is when you register, get plates or whatever. And if you don't do that, don't pay that tax, well, then they catch you driving down the road. They might treat you harshly. In extreme cases, the state can imprison a man for failure to pay the taxes that it requires of him, thus denying him the use of his life and liberty as well as his property. Every claim of taxation is a claim of prior ownership. It is a claim to sovereignty. That's the thing we've got to let sink in. Simply because a court trial or hearing is necessary prior to the state's confiscation of property or imprisonment of an individual for failure to pay taxes does not alter the juridical principle that stands behind the power to tax. So in other words, departing from the book again, even if they say, well, you have a right to a trial, that doesn't change anything. Yes, so they give you a trial and then imprison you or fine you. Whether a man has the right to a court trial or not, prior to having his liberty and or property confiscated, has no bearing on the issue of taxation. And I'm reading again. The issue, if it should be aired in court, is never whether the state has the power to tax or not. Did you hear that? When you go to court over these things, the issue is not whether the state has the power or authority to tax.
which that is the real issue. That's the real issue. But when you go to court, that's not even going to be mentioned, and you won't even be able to bring it up. They won't allow you to question whether they have that authority. Or at least that's their normal practice. So the issue is never whether the state has the power to tax or not, but only whether the tax is in conformity to higher law. For example, the Constitution, the people, etc., the Fuhrer, etc., and whether the tax has actually been paid or not. In other words, is it in agreement with their laws? And obviously they're going to have laws in place that they can appeal to. And whether the tax was paid or not. That's what the issue is. Normally they don't even really care whether there's a law. They just care whether there's a precedent, whether it's been done before, and whether you paid it or not. That's the only thing that the judge is going to allow anybody to consider in the court. Back to the book. The power to tax, which is the right of the owner or sovereign, is never an issue in such hearings or trials. The juridical principle of ownership of both man and his property is presupposed by the taxing authority and cannot be contested. And that, by the way, I'm departing from the book again, that is the heart of tyranny. Back to the book. Whoever claims the power to tax is claiming the right to sovereignty, and whoever claims the right to sovereignty claims and will exercise the power to tax. Every social organization, whether it is a democracy, aristocracy, monarchy, dictatorship of the proletariat, etc., is based upon this juridical principle of ownership. Whoever claims ultimate power in society is claiming to be the owner sovereign of that society, and it will exercise this power through taxation because taxation most clearly demonstrates who really owns and controls man and society. For example, if vox populi vox dei, which is Latin, which means the voice of the people is the voice of God, if that is the rule of society, then the people in the collective own everything. They will exercise their claim as God through taxation by taxing those who are considered as not being members of the people in order to demonstrate their power over them as their owners. This is why democracies invariably end up with extremely distorted and burdensome taxation. Every group in society claims that it is it, that is, that group is the true voice of the people and wants its own particular and peculiar ownership ideas put into force via taxation. Every group ends up trying to own every other group in society. Under such an arrangement, the group that can provide the largest appeal to the general populace will be the one that exercises the power of ownership. Since those who are successful in any society are always in a minority, they will end up being hated by every group. They will be hated by every group for the simple reason that their presence will constantly testify to the would-be gods of society that they are not truly the gods they claim to be. Why? Because no god is much of a god when those he owns are more successful than he is. To be a god, the people must be superior in every area of life and thought, especially in the areas of virtue, intellect, and wealth. For this reason, democracies inevitably end up reducing all moral, intellectual, and financial elements to the lowest common denominator in order that everyone may make his claim at being as God. That's a mouthful, isn't it? Oh, democracy is a wonderful thing, right? What has been said, I'm back to the book again, what has been said of democracies applies to every form of social organization. The voice of the taxing authority within society claims to be the voice of God. This voice claims total ownership and control over every area of life. This means, in principle, that every member of society is merely a steward of his life and property and not the owner. The owner is the sovereign. The individual simply takes care of his life and property and develops them in accordance to the wishes and dictates of the sovereign. All right, and I'm going to stop reading right there. But on that last phrase of that I just read. The truth is that we do have an owner, sovereign, and that we are merely stewards. This is true. It's just that the owner and sovereign is Yahweh, not the state. And whatever, you know, it talks about whatever group in society appeals to the largest group in society, well, they're the ones who get their way. In our society, you've got Republicans and Democrats claiming that they are the voice of the people. Each one wants their ideas interjected in society. They want to say where tax money goes and where it comes from. They want to be God. You know, every group wants to be God. And I'm going to read more from that in just a minute. But before I go to some scripture, I want to read out of Institutes of Biblical Law again, Rush Dooney. I read some of this to you last time as well. But let me read just this small part of this. One absolute, and I'm reading now, one absolute unchanging God means one absolute unchanging law. Men's social applications and approximations of the righteous God or of the righteousness of God may alter, vary, and waver, but the absolute law does not. To speak of the law as for Israel, but not for Christians, is not only to abandon the law, but also to abandon the God of the law. Since there is only one true God, and His law is the expression of His unchanging nature and righteousness, then to abandon the biblical law for another law system is to change gods. The moral collapse of Christendom is a product of this current process of changing gods. End quote. And he nails it on the head right there, doesn't he? So what we've gone through is a process of changing gods. We've changed the law systems and we recognize someone else as sovereign over us. Part of the way that we demonstrate that we've replaced Yahweh with someone else is by whom we offer tribute to and who we allow to demand tribute from us. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 13. This is where we stopped last time. And I want to go back through, what we read, but also more of Deuteronomy 13. Deuteronomy 13. And I really am going to get to the law of the tithe. This is all foundational because, again, the tithe is directly connected to authority and sovereignty. Our Lord has a right to expect the tithe from us, and really no one else does. So Deuteronomy 13, verse 1, if a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes true concerning which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods whom you have not known, and let us serve them. You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for Yahweh your God is testing you to find out if you love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You know, it's interesting that when he tests us, the test is always, are you going to obey my law? That's the test. It's not some emotional, fluffy, fun thing. It's not anything that, you know, that we can say, boy, this will be fun. It's just you simply obey. It's just cut and dry pretty much. Verse 4, you shall follow Yahweh your God and fear Him, and you shall keep His commandments. Listen to His voice, serve Him, and cling to Him. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he has counseled rebellion against Yahweh your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt. I'm competing here with a bird. Brought you from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery to seduce you from the way in which Yahweh your God commanded you to walk. So you shall purge the evil from among you. So again, as we said last time, what's the penalty
for leading people to violate the first commandment. The penalty is capital punishment. And who is this here? It's false prophets. People who are leading according to religion, according to doctrine, according to belief system. People who very possibly have some authority or some semblance of authority in a, say, perhaps a leader in the religious realm, a priest, prophet, so forth. But now let's go to verse 6. Verse 6, if your brother, your mother's son, or your son or daughter, or the wife you cherish, or your friend, who is as your own soul, entice you secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, whom neither you nor your fathers have known, of the gods of the peoples who are around you, near you or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other end, you shall not yield to him or listen to him, and your eyes shall not pity him, nor shall you spare or conceal him. But you shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. So you shall stone him to death because he has sought to seduce you from Yahweh your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Then all Israel will hear and be afraid and will never again do such a wicked thing among you. So now in verses 6 through 11, who's covered in that? Everybody, any individual who seeks to lead people from just obeying Yahweh, from keeping His law, living by His law. How, again, how do we depart from Yahweh? By departing from His law. We simply set up another law system. Another law system equals another God. And that's, we can find a lot of scripture to back that up. That wasn't Rush Dooney's original thought. He got it out of the scripture. Now let's start in verse 12. If you hear in one of your cities, which Yahweh your God is giving you to live in, anyone saying that some worthless men have gone out from among you and have seduced the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods whom we have not known, then you shall investigate. Listen, you've got to investigate and search out and inquire thoroughly. And if it is true and the matter established that this abomination has been done among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it and all that is in it, its cattle, even the critters, with the edge of the sword. Then you shall gather all its booty into the middle of its open square and burn the city and all its booty with fire as a whole burnt offering to Yahweh your God, and it shall be a ruin forever. It shall never be rebuilt. And nothing from that which is put under the ban shall cling to your hand. Don't carry anything out of there. Burn it all. In order that Yahweh may turn from his burning anger and show mercy to you, and have compassion on you and make your increase, just as he has sworn to your fathers. If you will listen to the voice of Yahweh your God, keeping all his commandments which I am commanding you today, and doing what is right in the sight of Yahweh your God. So, we saw the first part of the chapter dealt with false prophets, those who mislead probably from a religious realm. Then we saw anybody else in the next few verses, 6 through 11. Anybody else that tries to lead people astray. And then in this last section, it's interesting, it says in a city. The inhabitants of a city. Well, I looked up the word city and there was nothing really there to enlighten me. It was from an uncertain origin, which tells me that they really don't know what the word means. But it said a city or town. A city or town. Well, think about what that means, though. What is a city or town? What is a town or a city? It's an organization. It's a segment of society that's ordered. It's a separate, smaller entity of, say, a nation. But, you know, we've got in America today, we've got cities. We've got towns. We've got townships. We've got other types of municipalities. We've got... Jacob. we've got, say, towns that are incorporated, and we've got towns that are unincorporated. Most municipalities are incorporated in some way or form. They're corporations. All the way up to the U.S. government is a corporation. In Washington, D.C., they are a corporation with a geographical, you know, that 10-mile radius that is their corporate headquarters, so to speak, belongs to that corporation. They are a corporation. So what this really is a governmental element of society. In other words, this is a unit of society with an order. And so what Yahweh is saying, you see this city, this unit of society going a different way, what does he say to do with them? You search it out and find out if these men are leading these people this way, and if they're going this way, burn that city down. Utterly ruin it. And don't carry anything out of there, destroy it. And how does he see it? Don't build it again. He says it'll be a perpetual ruin. But when you burn it with fire, it'll be a burnt offering to Yahweh your God. It'll be a ruin forever. So, we've been listening to Ted Weiland's series on biblical law versus constitutionalism. Now, you know, when our founding fathers came over here, the original colonists, who established colonies on biblical law, and were establishing ecclesia or kingdom society, they said they were here to plant the kingdom right here. And they did. And law was Bible law. And Yahweh was king. Even if they didn't say Yahweh, that was the God they were talking about. Then by 1787, what took place was a departure from that. It wasn't to strengthen it or make it better. It was to depart from that. I mean, when they had the oaths that people had to take to hold office, which said, yeah, I'm a Christian, I serve Jesus, and I'm going to act according to Bible law. By 1787, what people were saying was, we can't allow that to go on. They were departing from. So, 1787 in Philadelphia, what if somebody heard that these men were attempting to introduce a new law system and a new order in society? What if some men of Israel heard, these men are trying to introduce something else and cause us to depart from serving Yahweh and from keeping His law and obeying Him? Because a change of law is a change of God, of gods. And we said, we have a better way. We want a government of the people, for the people, by the people, and we're going to run things. We got a better idea, a better way, new and improved. And we'll say who gets taxed and who doesn't. We'll say how much, or we'll be in control of our own destiny. What if some men of Israel heard that that's what they were doing? Should they have gone to Philadelphia and burned it down on top of those guys? They'd have been right in doing it. That's not what happened, is it? And then today, those who claim to serve Yahweh, exactly. Those who claim to serve Yahweh say, oh, the Constitution, wonderful Christian biblical document. So it's been a real good series, very eye-opening series that Ted is doing. If y'all haven't been listening to it, you ought to start. So this is just in keeping with what he's already teaching. So let's go to chapter 18, Deuteronomy chapter 18. You know, in 1787, I've read things in the past about Alexander Hamilton. Have y'all read much about him, know much about him? I tell you, the guy was no honorable man. He was no Christian. And he was the main instrument to push that Constitutional Convention through, to make it happen. And he was not a good man. And didn't say he was either, as far as I know. But in fact, I've read about him being an agent of the bankers. The bankers knew, the usurers knew, that they would never be able to have a central bank and control us through economy
without departing from Yahweh's law. They knew we had to depart from that law in order to be enslaved. And they had Alexander Hamilton and some others to help him. See, Yahweh knows it too. And he knew as soon as we departed from his law, we were our freedom, our property. It was all gone, our blessings. So it's been all downhill since then. So Deuteronomy 18 and verse 20 says, I haven't even gotten there. 18 verse 20 says, "But the prophet who shall speak a word presumptuously in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or which he shall speak in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die." Now, and I'm not going to go there, but in Exodus chapter 32, it's part of the story about, you know, Moses went up on the mountain, he got the Ten Commandments, he comes back down, and Aaron and the people have already, departed. And the people had Aaron build the calf and so forth. Without reading through all that, because you almost need to read the chapter, at least a great deal of it, to get the picture. Do you remember what happened to some of those people? Exodus 32, when Moses came down off the mountain, there were people who had to die for that. Thousands of people were slain there as a result. So again, what's the punishment for departing and leading people to depart from to violate the first commandment? The punishment is death. Punishment's death. Let's go to Psalm 24. But before you get there, again, I want to reiterate that number one, Yahweh has authority. He has the authority to demand a tithe from us because of who He is. The Almighty, Omniscient One, our Creator. Because of who He is, He has the right, He has the authority to demand and expect this tithe of us. Then number two, the second reason, is because of number one. Because of who He is. Because He is the Creator of all. He owns it all. It all belongs to Him. He has every right to demand that a portion of what He's entrusted to us be returned to Him to be used as He desires. We own nothing. Resources He's placed at our disposal are only ours in the form of a trust or a stewardship. So, these things are only ours in the form of a trust or a stewardship. He owns everything. So, Psalm 24, and I haven't gotten there. Psalm 24, verse 1. The earth is Yahweh's, and some of the things therein. No. What does King James say there, Brian?
The earth is Yahweh's and the fullness.
The fullness therein, right? So, but what it means is everything that it contains. Its fullness, or all it contains, as the New American Standard says. Now listen to the whole verse that now in New American Standard. The earth is Yahweh's and all it contains, the world and those who dwell in it. How many people does the state of Tennessee own? How many souls does the federal government own? Zero. Because Yahweh owns it all, and he's not delegated anything to them. Again, it goes back to authority. Psalm 50. Psalm 50, verse 10. For every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on a thousand hills. I know every bird of the mountains, and everything that moves in the field is mine. So again, does he claim to own it all? Absolutely. He claims to own it all. Haggai, chapter 2. Haggai, Haggai chapter 2 and verse 8 says, "The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, declares Yahweh of hosts." When Christ, again, we mentioned this last time, was being questioned about, is it lawful to pay this tax to Caesar? He says, hand me a denarius. He says, whose image is on there? And they told him it was Caesar's image. Jesus said then, well, render to Caesar what's Caesar's and to Yahweh what's Yahweh's. You think he was familiar with this verse? Do you think that Yahweh claims to own it all? Did he say anything to those guys about whose is what? Or how much is Yahweh's and how much is Caesar's? What's Caesar's cut and what's Yahweh's cut? He didn't say anything. He didn't say anything about any of that. He just very shrewdly answered, well, render to Caesar what's Caesar's and to Yahweh what's Yahweh's. And he let them figure out whose was what, or what was whose. So he knew that it all belongs to the Almighty One. Ezekiel chapter 18. Behold, I'm sorry, verse 4. 18 and verse 4. Behold, all souls are mine, the soul of the Father as well as the soul of the Son is mine. The soul who sins will die. So again, he claims ownership to all souls, as he did in Psalm 24, leaving none for the state of Tennessee to own. The state of Tennessee owns none. And when I get there, I'm going to address the issue of property too. He has left them no property to own. Romans chapter 14. Romans chapter 14. And verse 8. For if we live, we live for Yahweh. Or if we die for Yahweh. Therefore, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. Dead or alive, Adriel?
Dead or alive, you belong to Yahweh. Isn't that right? Dead or alive, who do you belong to, Jacob?
Yahweh. Oh, you're not your own? Aren't you your own? Don't you at least? That's right, you're not. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 20. For you have been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. And again, reminding us, we're bought with a price. We're not our own. Flip over to chapter 10, 1 Corinthians 10. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 26. For the earth is Yahweh's and all it contains. And again, he's probably quoting from the Psalms. Or at least he's paraphrasing from the Psalms, I should say. All that it contains. So the New Testament writers, including Paul, knew who owned things. So if Yahweh owns it, what then is our proper position? Our proper attitude toward the things that he gives us or entrusts us with? If you go back to Genesis chapter 1, Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26 says, Then Yahweh said, Let us make man, which is Adam, let us make Adam in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. How about reading your King James there, Brian, verse 26, would you?
Yahweh said, Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish and the sea. Is that what you wanted?
That's right. That's good. I want you to notice a couple things. Of course, the New American Standard said rule. King James said dominion. But both translations said this. Let them rule. Let them. have dominion. Now, how can he let us or let Adam have or do anything except he's got the authority? It's his. So he lets Adam. He said, let us. We'll let them rule. We'll let them have dominion. Dominion is his to give. And dominion is not dominion or ownership separate from him. The order stays in place. In other words, we have dominion only as long as we're operating within his order of authority. Verse 28 says, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. And he gives a command, fill the earth and subdue it and rule over. Does King James say have dominion over, Brian? In verse 28, and have dominion over? Yes. And have dominion over, or rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So again, he says, here's what I want you to do. Fill the earth, subdue it, rule over it. Take dominion. Take dominion. And that's what he commanded us to do. Did he ever acquiesce ownership? Did he sign something, say, it's all yours now, I'm out of here, I'm leaving town, you do with this as you please? No. No, he didn't do that. I had one of these books I wanted to read out of, and unfortunately, I did not. I did not make a note, so I don't remember where it is now. So I guess I won't read it. I didn't get my notes finished. But the bottom line is this. Oh, here it is right here.
I do have it.
All right, this is in Tithing and Dominion. We're talking about stewardship. We're talking about who rightly owns or who truly owns all this and what our proper relationship is with Yahweh and with the things that He owns. So out of Tithing and Dominion again, and I read, the juridical principles of ownership and stewardship are inescapable. Regardless of the form that society may take, all men within that society are seen as stewards to the prevailing god or gods of that society. Think about that. Does the state of Tennessee think that you're just a steward of things they own? Absolutely they do. That's how they can fine you or put you in jail if you're driving around in a car that you haven't paid tax to be driving around in. That's how they can take property from you if you don't pay tax. Again, just the things we've been reading already, but regardless of the form that society may take, in other words, regardless of what form of government, whether you call yourself a democracy or a constitutional republic or an imperialism or a monarchy or whatever you call yourself, a socialism, whatever you call yourself, whatever the form that society may take, all men within society are seen as stewards to the prevailing god or gods of that society. So when Yahweh is the god of our society, to whom do we give tribute? To Yahweh. Who else? None. We would recognize no other. If anybody doesn't know and they're listening to this, they may think, well, Romans 13 or some of these other passages like Peter say to give tribute and pay taxes to the government, etc. Well, tax or tribute in theocracy, in a Yahweh's law kingdom society, the tithe would go to a government which is enforcing Yahweh's law. The administration of law would bring about the things that the tithe is designed to do. And the tithe would accomplish those things, like bringing justice to the evildoers and so forth. That's the ministry of government, is justice. So, The reason, reading again now, the reason that this concept is inescapable is because it was established by the God of Scriptures from the very beginning of creation. Because God created man and his world, God saw and sees himself as the owner of man and creation. We just read all that, didn't we? Since God created the world and upholds it by the word of his power, he demands that man be a steward of his life and property to the glory of God. Man was created solely by God to be a steward, to glorify God by using and developing his world and himself in terms of the revealed law or word of God. Because God created man to be a steward to his creator owner, man cannot escape this concept in any social organization that he may establish, regardless of whether that society should be godly or ungodly. Since these juridical principles are inescapable, it can be seen that every society begins with a basic theological presupposition as to who is sovereign owner and who is steward creature. Every society begins with a religious presupposition as to the absolute distinction between the ruler of society and the ruled within society. Now, is that a mouthful of truth right there? It's, all those principles are in the Scriptures. But he says it very well here, very succinctly, that you cannot have a society that isn't built on this premise. It just depends on who they say God is. But ultimately, all government becomes humanistic if it departs from theocracy. And there are men, people, who are claiming to be the rulers, and they demand tribute. So, there it is again. We're here as stewards. Another principle I want to establish before we get to the law of the tithe is the fact that the tithe did not begin with Moses at Sinai any more than Yahweh's law began with Moses at Sinai. The law did not begin there. Yahweh has always had a law, an absolute unchanging law, and always will. The dispensationalists would have us believe that law started with Moses at Sinai, and it stopped at the cross, and then in the kingdom fullness or millennium or whatever, depending on who you're talking to, maybe the law will be established again. Like, you know, the Almighty can't make up his mind how he wants to govern his kingdom. But the truth is, he's always had a law. It's been absolute and unchanging, and it's always contained a tithe to him. He's always had that right. He's always expected it and received it. Let's go to Genesis chapter 26. Genesis 26 and verse 5, regarding the law itself, it says, "Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." Now here we are several hundred years before Moses, and Abraham's obeying his commandments and laws. One of the ways he did this, you can see in Genesis chapter 14. Genesis chapter 14 and verse 20. "And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand, and he gave him a tenth of all." So Abram, of course this is Melchizedek, king of Salem, and we've talked about some of this before. I won't get into it now. But the bottom line is that Abram knew about tithing. How did Abram know about tithing? Well, he somehow was able to keep Yahweh's commandments and laws, so he knew something. He had something to go by. And tithing was a part of it. Again, in Genesis chapter 28, we see tithing again. Genesis 28 and verse 20 says, "Then Jacob made a vow, saying, 'If God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take, and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then Yahweh will be my God. And this stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that thou dost give me, I will surely give a tenth to thee.'" So Jacob knew something about tithing. Again, several hundred years before Moses. Abram and Jacob knew about tithing. So, I'm running about to the end of time, and I wanted to, before I close today, I wanted to read through Malachi 3 again, and I wanted to touch on a couple of the questions that we had last time before we, or after our study last week. We had some good comments that were made, and I want to touch on that a little bit. So that everybody knows where I'm coming from and what we're really saying. Malachi 3. And verse 6 says, "For I, Yahweh, do not change. Therefore you, O sons of Jacob, are not consumed. From the days of your fathers, you have turned aside from my statutes and have not kept them." So again, he's talking about departing from him and his statutes. "Return to me, and I will return to you," says Yahweh of hosts. "But you say, how shall we return? Will a man rob God? Yet you are robbing me. But you say, how have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings." So, again, when he begins this discussion of how to return, he starts with, "Make sure the whole tithe gets into my storehouse. This is how you can start returning to me." I think that in our society today, we're more concerned with making sure that we pay our humbugs and tyrants over us what they demand than we are with making sure Yahweh gets all that He's requested or what He's commanded us to return to Him. We're more afraid of them because they'll come grab us, throw us out of our house. They'll drag us and throw us into jail. They'll take things from us. So we're more afraid of them. We have more fear for them than we do for Yahweh. And many, many churchgoers, I guarantee you, who pay every dime that the revenuers demand are not paying 10% of what. And again, even to look at Yahweh's tithe and the law of the tithe is just simply a 10% to the church is without understanding. And we're going to get to that when we actually get to the law. But we talked about some things last week before we before we left here. It was after we quit recording. But I think Brian was the one who mentioned how a lot of the taxes we pay today, we don't even have any say about whether we pay them or not. And that's absolutely true. But if you remember last week, I mentioned a thug coming up to you with a pistol on the street, I think, saying, "Hand me your wallet." What are you going to do? Probably hand him your wallet. Probably. And we need to understand that that's basically the way it's working right now. It's not rightful authority. It's thugs with guns. Let's call it what it is. Yahweh has rightful authority to tax, to collect tithe. And many of the taxes that are collected from us today, we absolutely don't have any say about. For instance, I go to a store and buy a can of beans. They put tax on it.
Right.
At the grocery store. And it's in Tennessee, 9.25%. And they don't say now, that's whatever, 73 cents. And you say, "Well, but I didn't want to pay the tax. I just want to pay for the beans." I mean, if you say, "Well, I don't want to pay the tax. I just want the beans." What are they going to say? They're going to look at you like you're crazy. If you get too persistent, they'll probably call 911. Yeah. What if you go get gas and you go in to pay for your gas and you say to the clerk now, and she says, "That'll be $50 or, you know, more and more. It's like $70 or $100. And you say, "But wait a minute, I just want gas. Look, I just want to pay for the gas. I don't want to pay the tax. I can't afford all those taxes. Just sell me the gas." And again, if you're too adamant in that position, they're going to call somebody. So you don't have any say. And you don't have an opportunity. There are some things you may have an opportunity. For instance, a hunting license. I had a guy tell me a while back, he said, "I don't mind paying for a hunting license because that's what pays for the conservation efforts. They, you know, they try to help maintain a good, healthy supply of fish. You know, they
stock some of these creeks and so forth around here. They try to keep the deer herds healthy and, you know, try to keep it all in balance. And he says, I don't mind paying for a hunting license. That's fine, because that money goes to doing something that he believes in, and that's fine. On the other hand, you have some freedom in that you don't have to buy a hunting license. Nobody comes to your house and arrests you if you didn't buy a hunting license this year. So it's not a particularly harmful tax. The case could be made that the king doesn't own the deer and therefore can't tax you for hunting the deer. The deer belonged to Yahweh. The case could be made scripturally, but I'm not going to argue on whether a guy should buy a hunting license or not. You know, you may buy it just because it's easier and it keeps you from having hassles that you don't have time to mess with. But that's what it amounts to. But if I didn't buy a hunting license this year, I didn't spend the $50 or $60, whatever it would have been. I had a choice to do that, and nobody has molested me because I didn't go buy a hunting license. See? So, but now, property tax is a vile thing. This federal income tax is as well. And you don't have any say about how they spend all that money. And that's a part of the problem. However, are we enslaved? Are we in bondage? Yes, we are. We are in bondage.
You got caught out in the woods with a rifle and no license, and you got arrested.
Oh, absolutely. You get caught in the woods with a rifle and no license, you'd have been treated like a real serious criminal.
Yeah.
So, but as far as other taxes, do you think that Daniel and the other Hebrew men in bondage there in Babylon, do you think that they had to pay some tribute or tax? Probably. I'd say they probably did. I'd say all Babylonian citizens were taxed. So every man has to do what his conscience leads him to do. Some men feel in their conscience pricked to not cooperate with the tyrants on some of these taxes. Some men feel perfectly clear in their conscience to pay all of them, and plenty of them. But we all have to answer to Yahweh for what we do or don't do. That's for sure. And I could take some adamant positions and feel that I have scripture to back it up. On the other hand, we are enslaved. And nobody asks you, you know, as you were showing me that form earlier about this voluntary system, it's not a voluntary system. Even when they called it voluntary, it's not voluntary. And so we're enslaved. We're subjugated. And it is the same as a thug coming up to you with a gun on a street and saying, hand me your wallet. You know, we usually are going to try to preserve our life, hand over the wallet. And the thugs that have official identification card and represent some level or agency of government, they are armed and they can just take the money from you. And, hey, we hand it over. So a proper biblical position, you know, men, we have to be led by our conscience and convictions, and we have to answer to Yahweh for what we do or don't do. So I'm not telling anybody, pay this tax, don't pay that one, pay this one, don't pay that one. But I am wanting to show a true perspective of who has authority. Just because someone says they have authority doesn't mean they have authority. And all of this is an issue of authority and sovereignty, and it all comes to the first commandment. And there is a place that we do violate the first commandment when we bow down to men. Again, in the New Testament church, when they had their homes and lands taken from them, it's because they weren't bowing down. It's not because they were having big praise and worship services. You know, that's not what got the government upset with them. So we'll do some more questions and comments here in a minute. But did I kind of think I kind of covered that part anyway? Well enough for now. And I realize too that in this, we haven't even gotten to the law of the tithe itself yet, because so much of it goes back to these foundational elements of authority and the first commandment. We're going to get to the law of the tithe, but I may have to spend more time. I may have to deal with passages in the New Testament, like Romans 13, a little bit. I mean, we've dealt with all that many times in the past. But I may have to touch on some of those passages again, because the truth is we do submit to authority. And we had better submit to authority. But most people today, in what calls itself New Testament church, most people who call themselves Christian have no concept of authority, of lawful and rightful authority, and do not see tyranny as it is tyranny. I may pay the same taxes as this guy right here, and he says, oh, I'm glad to give it. This is what God has commanded me to do. And I may say, no, I gave it because they had a gun to my head. They don't have authority for anything, any of this. You know? So perspective is everything. At some point, you've got to come to at least understand and realize the truth so that when the time comes, we can protest and say, we don't believe this. We're not going to do this anymore. There's a time coming. If we're going to have thy kingdom come and we're going to live under theocracy, there's a time coming when we must say no more. Somebody will. Whether it's our generation or Jacob's generation or his son. But somebody's got to. And in 1787, some men of Israel should have been rounded up and said, you're departing from our Lord's kingdom. You're throwing our Lord out of here. You're coming up with a different way. We're departing from Yahweh's law. You're causing us to depart from the first commandment. And here's what the scripture says we have to do with you. And that would have shut that down in a hurry, wouldn't it? In fact, I'll bet if somebody had just come up there with a gang of men and started reading from these passages, said, that's what you guys are doing, they might have all fled Philadelphia and the convention never even held. You know?
Somebody dropped the ball.
We dropped the ball a long time ago and we continue to leave it laying there, dropped. And somebody's going to have to pick it up. So, volunteers? You're always looking for volunteers. Who's going to pick the ball up? That's what he says when he says, I look for a man to stand in the gap. I'm looking for somebody to pick up the ball. All right. Pardon me?
Just men, right?
Well.